you try to implement them, you may have some more complicated phase diagrams. However, there are proposals to actually to implement the Z2 gauge theory. Another model that is believed to have this type of properties is the Heisenberg model on a Kagome lattice. Okay, but this is not a completely settled. So many of these topics are topics of research. Okay. So we want a lattice. Okay. So we start with our favorite lattice, that is the square lattice. Then we will see what to do with it. With the periodic boundary conditions, okay? So I identify this line with this line and this line with this line. Or, and I draw it here because later I will need this picture. It's, this thing is wrapped around the torus. So you have to imagine that the lattice goes in this way. Okay. So yesterday, we saw what it means to do a quantum gauge theory. Okay. To do a quantum gauge theory, we need to define a gauge structure. Defining a gauge structure means that you have a multi-to-one labeling for the states in your Hilbert space. So how do you do a multi-to-one labeling? You start from a larger Hilbert space, and then you in which labels correspond to different states, and then you identify the states. Okay. So if you call G the transformation between the states in the larger Hilbert space, so you have some local transformation. In the larger Hilbert space, then the gauge structure is obtained by saying that psi is the same thing than psi prime. Actually, I should say it's the same thing. So this means that my gauge invariant Hilbert space is the set of states in the total Hilbert space, the one where I have one-to-one labeling, such that G psi is equal to psi. Right? I'm imposing this thing. So this operation of going from H tot to this, what type of operation you think it is? Huh?
The quotient H total by the action.
Yes, but what I mean is that this space is a subspace of H tot that obeys this constraint. So this is a surface, hypersurface in this. So this operation is a projection. Okay, so you have your total Hilbert space, and then you have this constraint, g psi is equal to psi, and this makes something like this. So you have some state, and then you have some projection pi of g, such that for every state, I go to the one, so for every state psi tilde, I go to the projected one such that g psi is equal to psi. Okay. So in order to make a gauge structure, we need to find, so we have to identify these labels with these labels. And in practice, what you need to do is to find the projection operator. Okay? So now let's define. So to define the gauge structure, we have to define first our total Hilbert space, then to define what is my transformation inside the total Hilbert space, and then define the projection operators that will define the gauge structure. Okay. So we place spins 1 half on the bonds of the lattice, just like we did in the classical case. So if this lattice is L times L, so how many sides do I have? Of course, I have L squared, right? And how many links do I have? Huh?
It's easier.
2L squared. Very good. Well, yeah. Okay. So, you study crystals in chemistry. So, the reason why it's 2L squared is because for every side, there are 4 edges, but every edge is shared by 2 sides. So the ratio between the 2 is 2. So, okay. And so we have a spin 1 half at every link. So this means that our total Hilbert space is the tensor product of all these spins 1 halves, 2L squared times. Therefore, the dimension of the total Hilbert space is 2 to the 2L squared. Okay, so far, so good. Now, let me erase this picture here. Okay. Okay. Now we want to define our local gauge transformation. So yesterday we called it G of N. So you have to forgive me, sometimes I will call it A of N. So I will try to be consistent, but forgive me if I switch between these two notations. So anyway, let's start from this. And so for every site N, so I'm labeling the sites by N, I consider all the edges that come out from it, and I flip them in the Z basis. It's what we did yesterday with the classical theory. So I apply sigma x. So this is a definition. My transformation is the product on all the sites that belong to a site n of sigma x j. So in the total Hilbert space, a basis state psi is a spin configuration. So it means that for every edge, I decide if it's up or down. And Gn of psi is a different distinguishable spin configuration. Just like when we described the particle on the line yesterday, the particle at x and the particle at x plus a are 2 different states, okay? So this is psi in the Hilbert space. But now that our gauge structure is defined by the saying that this is the set of states in the total one that obey this constraint, that gen of psi is equal to psi for every n. I just repeated what I wrote before. So you immediately see that spin configurations are not in this Hilbert space. Because If psi is a spin configuration, this is a different spin configuration. So the spin degrees of freedom are not gauge invariant, are not a good basis in this space. So whereas here, to every spin configuration corresponds a basis state in my Hilbert space, and it is a good state in the Hilbert space, here spin configurations are not inside here. They do not have this property. So we need to find what they are. Okay, so let's try to understand what is the projection operator onto this subspace. So first of all, notice that all these operators commute for different ends. So that I'm using this now, but know that for more complicated theories where these things do not commute, you just need a little bit more care, but this is not essential. I use it now. By the way, before I go ahead, of course, like yesterday, this group, this local group is Z2. Okay? Because it contains two elements. One is the identity, and one is Gn. And this is true because Gn square is the identity. And also Gn is a unitary operator, right? Because it's just the product of these polymatrices. So the Z2 theory is very easy from the algebraic point of view. Yes? Yeah, we'll get there in a second. Let's define H gauge properly, and then we get there in a second.
Can we define the space time as, for example, superpositions of different spin states?
Yes. 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 Yeah. Yes. The answer to your questions is in the next 5 minutes. Right. Okay. So the local Z2. So remember, it's local. It's not a global transformation. It's this. So there is one Z2 for every site n. Okay? Okay. So first of all, let's define this projection operator. Let's find it. But because they all commute, my projection operator can be let me call it P. Can be written like the product of Pn's, of many projection operators, where each of these projects onto the subspace where this one is obeyed. Okay? Because you see, I have many constraints. I have to obey this constraint at the site n, this other constraint at another site n prime, and so on. So my total projection operator is the product of many projections until I get to this final surface where all these constraints are obeyed. Okay? Okay, so basically we just need to find this one. Okay, so let suggesting, what do you think it is, this project? Can you guess it? I think that you basically are there, but why don't you tell me what is Pn? So just give me the formula in terms of operators. So this is an operator. Almost. Okay. So, what do you say? Psi plus. Almost. It's this. is this. Okay, let's prove it, okay? So first of all, we have to prove that this is a projector, which means to prove that, okay, so we need to prove that that p squared is p. Well, but this is, I don't want to offend you by proving this. Do you see it? So if you square this, remember this squares to the identity. So the square of this is twice the identity plus 2gn, the 2 goes away and they have 1 plus gn. Okay, so p squared is equal to p. Okay, now the second thing that is also easy, but less easy. Let me define psi prime. So let me get some state psi. Its projection is p psi, that I will call psi prime. Okay? Now, if this is the projector onto this subspace, then g psi prime should be psi prime. So we want to prove this. This is what we want to prove. Okay. So let's do it. This is a g p psi. So this is g 1 plus g over 2 psi. And this is g plus 1, right? Because g squared is 1 over 2 psi. But this is p, right? So this is p psi. So this is psi prime. OK. Oh, so this is the projector. So the only thing that you have to be careful is that when you do projections, the final state is not an array. You need to normalize it, right? So projections, as you know, they don't preserve length, right? So at the end, we have to normalize. So the final state P psi is the product over all these guys. Okay. If I expand this product, so forget the two, because in the end I need to normalize anyway. So I will have some normalization that we will find out later what it is. And then I have this sum. This sum is 1 plus, sorry, let me write it like this. 1 plus the sum over all my transformations plus the sum over all the pairs of transformations plus the sum over all the triples, and so on and so forth. And this big sum is operated on psi. So now you see the answer to your question. This is a spin, this can be a spin configuration, for instance. So it can be whatever, but for the sake of simplicity, imagine that this is a state in the total Hilbert space. And it's a basis state, so I choose a spin configuration. Then when I have itself plus I flip some of them, you know, in many different ways. Then I flip some of them and do the superposition of all of this. So you see how it is the superposition of the basis states in my total Hilbert space, if you want to see it in the original degrees of freedom, okay? And the second question that you had was, and it's an important question, is what is the dimension of this new Hilbert space? So this is important to know, because we want to know how to write. So we want to know, find the basis in the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So we need to understand at least how many degrees of freedom we have. So if I can erase this. So you see that every time I do a projection, I half the dimension of the Hilbert space, right? Because I am choosing a specific eigenvalue of this guy. So how many gauge transform, how many projectors do we have? L squared, right? But there is a caveat. Now we need to remember that we have periodic boundary conditions. When you have periodic boundary conditions, you see that we have this global constraint that the product over all the sites of Gn is the identity. Do you see that? If I multiply all these star operators, so when I multiply these two, I erase this, right? Because I have x squared. Then I multiply these two and I erase this one. Then when I start multiplying in this direction, I erase the vertical ones. And then in the end, I have to close. And everything is the identity. So you see, once I have fixed the eigenvalue of L squared minus one of them, fixing eigenvalue means this, right? That this means a Gn has eigenvalue plus one. Once I've decided that L squared minus one have eigenvalue plus one, since the product of all of them is the identity, so it must have eigenvalue plus one, so also the last one has automatically eigenvalue plus one. So I only have L squared minus one independent projections. So another way you can see this is that these objects in the total Hilbert space are quantum numbers, right? Like some sort of angular momentum. They're good quantum numbers because they all commute, okay? So I can use them as a basis in the total Hilbert space, as part of a basis in the total Hilbert space. So when I fix four of them, the remaining Hilbert space has dimension 2 to the 2L squared minus 4. Right? But I cannot fix more than this independently because the last one comes automatically. So when I fix all of them in this way, all the allowed ones, this dimension is the total dimensions minus L squared minus 1, which is 2 to the squared plus 1. So you see, this is the dimension of the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So we would like it to, so this is the Hilbert space of L squared plus one new spins. Not the original spins, not the spins that are on the bonds. Some other spins, by spins I mean operators that have two eigenvalues, plus one and minus one. So that the dimension of the Hilbert space spanned by these degrees of freedom is 2 to the L squared plus 1. So we need to find them out, okay? So who are they? So what is, so now we are in the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So to know who are the gauge, I already said, to know what are these spins, they must be gauge invariant quantities. Because if they were non-gauge invariant quantities, a basis made of these degrees of freedom would not obey the gauge constraint. So it would not be a basis in this space. But yesterday we learned what are the gauge invariant quantities. It was in the classical case, but here the algebra is the same. So what are the gauge invariant quantities? The loops. Very good. So these guys, let me label these plaquettes by P and apply sigma z here everywhere. So let me define my my good gauge invariant quantum numbers as the product on the edges that are around the plaquette of sigma z. So these are good quantum numbers because, as we saw yesterday, they commute with my gauge structure. Remember? Right? Because this operator and this operator, either they don't share any edge in common, and being spin operators with every disjoint supports the commute, or they share two. So it's a simple exercise to so even if z and x anti-commute, when you have the product of two anti-commutations, you have a commutation. So it's do it as an exercise. It's very straightforward. So these guys commute, and also the BPs all commute with each other. So they're good quantum numbers. So how many of them do we have? How many plaquettes do we have? What is the number of plaquettes? You must know this. Yeah, the number of plaquettes is L squared. And you know, because when you have periodic boundary conditions, and you do a dual transformation. So for every plaquette, you have a site in the new lattice, right? And it's a one-to-one. However, exactly for this reason, we also have this. So we have L squared minus one independent projections, but we only have L squared minus one independent BP. So we have only L squared minus one quantum numbers. It's for the same reason. I'm trying to find the basis in here, right? So I can say, oh, my basis states are something like, I take the first plaquette, and I tell you if this is plus one or minus one. Then I say, take the second plaquette, and I tell you if this is plus one or minus one. And so on and so forth. Then I arrive at the plaquette number L squared minus one, and I decide if it's plus one and minus one. Now the last one, is fixed, because the product of all of them must be one. So once I've decided this configuration of plaquettes, the other one is fixed by this constraint. So you see, we have only, we are labeling in this way, only 2 to the L squared minus 1 basis states in the new Hilbert space. So there are two missing. So let me call these two missing ones Z1 and Z2. I mean, just two other things that can have the value plus one and minus one. So before I go ahead, is it crystal clear in what sense this is a basis in this Hilbert space? These are degrees of freedom that are gauge invariant. So this is, they label states that are orthogonal in this Hilbert space. But as you can see, with these degrees of freedom, I can only find the basis in an 2L squared minus 1 subspace of the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So to find it, it's not a basis of the full Hilbert space. It's a basis for almost all, but it's a subspace. So we need two more degrees of freedom. Yeah, well, who won?
The constraint that the product of the BP is equals one?
Yeah. Okay.
So,
look, what happens when I multiply many plaquettes together? So you see, the interior cancels because it squares to the identity, right? So when I multiply many, I have this boundary. Okay, but then I am going in this direction, and in this direction, and they. Okay.
A loop around one inner torus and around the other.
Okay. Hey. These are the missing degrees of freedom. Okay. So let's understand why. Because, so first of all, so we have two missing degrees of freedom, okay? And they must be gauge invariant. So there must be some gauge invariant quantity. So what about larger loops? So first of all, so what about this loop? So this is also gauge invariant. Can I use it to label the states? Why not? Because it's the product of stuff that I've already used. So these eigenvalues already fixed, right? Because it's the product of some other eigenvalues. But if you take this loop, which means the product of sigma z, so I was using the pink for this z. Anyway, right? This is a loop, or this one. They still are gauge invariant, right? Because the only thing that makes something gauge invariant is that it's a closed curve. Then it would always, right? It would, what happens when I do a gauge transformation? Again, it shares two edges. Now it shares two edges that are parallel and not orthogonal, but the algebra is the same. So these are, they commute. But they are not the product of plaquettes. Because the product of plaquettes, by definition, is contractible to a point. Because then I can just multiply all the plaquettes until I get the identity. And these are not contractible to a point. So for topological reasons, these two are independent. So if you, in general, let me define this operator that, so let be gamma a curve on the lattice. So this is a curve that runs on the links. Let me define WZ of gamma like the product for all the links that are in gamma of sigma Z. Again, this is an operator that has two eigenvalues, plus one and minus one. And then I say that Z1 is WZ for this cut, this curve C1. And similarly for the other one, W2 is C2. Okay, so I specify a basis state in my gauge invariant Hilbert space by telling you whether for every plaquette this is plus one or minus one. So, and then we will use this language that when we have a plus one, so by the way, why we have plus? So what does it mean this? Remember, we are taking the product of sigma z along this path. So now imagine sigma z is like a field, right? So this is like the circuitation of this field. So when, and this circuitation, instead like when you do it in electromagnetism, that can be any number, any real number. That's why we call it U1, because it can be any number. This can only have two values, plus one or minus one. So we say that when it's minus one, so this is a convention, we say that there is a vortex inside. And when there is plus one, there is no vortex. And Z2 vortex, because my field is Z2. Okay. So, and then we have the circuitation of the Z2 field around this loop, which means that if it's plus one, there is no vortex inside the torus, whereas if it is minus one, there is a vortex here at the center of the torus. Okay, Z2 vortex. So you don't have to imagine metaphysical entities. This is a cartoon to say this, that these things have eigenvalues. But the point is that this object is somehow localized, right? It's a specific plaquette. Then later we will see how we can interpret it actually as a particle. Yeah?
If you go to like a larger loop, then you say that there's only one vortex inside, or is there a vortex inside for every single individual plaquette of the minus
one? Ah, very good. So this is a Z2 field, so we can just have the expectation value, one of these loops can be only plus one and minus one. So in that case, we will not talk for larger loops about vortices, okay? So we only talk about vortices for these degrees of freedom. As I said, this is a convention. This convention will need an interpretation later, okay? I will give you an interpretation in a minute. Why we say that these are vortices and not the eigenvalues of some other operators, okay? So the question you should ask me is, oh, but what happens if I take another non-contractible loop? You know, I chose one, you know, but do I have another degree of freedom? So the answer must be no, right? Because we have labeled the whole Hilbert space. So we already know on algebraic grounds that there cannot be other degrees of freedom because we have already found the basis. Okay, yeah, but why? Why another loop doesn't give me an independent degrees of freedom? Please.
By multiplying more of the blocks.
Mm-hmm. So all the non-contractible loops, so this one based here, and another one based somewhere else, even deformed, that is also non-contractible, well, you can continuously deform it by applying gauge transformations. Because when I apply a gauge transformation here, not gauge transformation, by applying these plaquette operators, when I play a plaquette operator here, I cancel this and I've deformed it, you see? So, and I can, by putting many, I can shift it, and then I can create anything. So they are all obtained one from the other by using other BPs, so there are no new independent ones. Okay, so we have labeled our Hilbert space. So we finally know that my gauge invariant Hilbert space is the tensor product of all these C2s. Let me use this notation. And then I have this guy and this guy. So these are spins one half, meaning each of these spaces is a two-level system. It is a two-dimensional Hilbert space. It's a C2, each of them. So I say whether there is a vortex here or not, whether there is a vortex or not, whether there is a vortex or not, whether there is a vortex here or not. What is that? So what is weird about this Hilbert space is that it's non-local, right? So these look like local degrees of freedom in terms of the original spins. But these are not local degrees of freedom, right? So if I really think I want to realize the system in an extended system, this is a very non-local degree of freedom. So it's hardly imaginable that in this gauge theory exists in nature. Okay, so let's keep this in mind, because in the end, you know, we want to describe phases of, you know, as abstract, you know, we are being, but we want to describe real quantum many body systems. So let's keep this in mind. So now we have the gauge structure. We have identified the states, and we know what is the Hilbert space. Now finally, we must show an Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian must respect the gauge structure. Otherwise, it would mean that you don't know what is the energy, right? Because you could have two states that are actually the same state, but have different energy. So this means that this has to commute with the gauge structure. So you see, in some sense, this is not a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. This is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian if I wrote the Hamiltonian as an operator on the total Hilbert space. But as an operator on the gauge invariant Hilbert space, it's not a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. It's just a consistency. It's exactly the same thing that we saw in the difference between the particle on a line and the particle on the circle. So the same object was commuting with the same Hamiltonian, but had two completely different meanings, because what matters is the Hilbert space. Because in one case, Gn is a transformation. The other case, Gn is not a transformation. It's a transformation between labels, not between something physical. OK, so let's give this Hamiltonian. So you know it must contain gauge invariant quantities. And we want these gauge invariant quantities to be as local as possible. So we can sum over all the Plaquette operators. And you remember when we were doing the classical theory, that was it, right? But the quantum theory is richer. And if you imagine that you do the classical to quantum mapping, you would already be able to guess what is the next term. But even if you don't guess, we just need to put the most local operators that commute with the Gn. And so there is another one that always commutes with Gn, and this is the localest one that you can have. Not surprisingly, it's a transverse field. So if you do the classical quantum mapping, you would find it this way. But you can just, you know, exhibit it here by the request that is the most local Hamiltonian that commutes with the Gn. OK. So this is our Hamiltonian. And let's see the properties of this Hamiltonian. Yeah.
Are we in the sum of the Bs, the BPs, are we also taking into account the loops, the big loops, or
no, the BPs? So the loops, I call them Ws or Z. Okay, it's just the BPs, but it's all of them, not L square minus one. Okay, so I can still sum over all of them, even if one of them is dependent from the others.
Set G equal zero, you get a fourfold degeneracy.
Yeah, well, we can get there. Okay, right now. So let's examine this Hamiltonian in the two limits. Okay, Let's look at the ground state in the two limits. So I don't have much to say. So this limit, we already studied it. When g is infinite, or when j is 0, so when you only have this Hamiltonian, the ground state is the paramagnet, the boring paramagnet. We already know, we studied it, it's the same ground state of the Ising model, because it's the same Hamiltonian. We already know that this ground state is unique, that is, there is no magnetization, that all correlation functions decay exponentially, and all that. It's the same one, okay? You wanted to ask a question?
I'm just confused, because PPs are actually operators, okay?
Yeah.
So if you want to describe the Hilbert space, you can write it not in terms of the operators, but in terms of these eigenvectors.
Of its eigenvalues, which is exactly what I did. When I say that BP is equal plus or minus 1, I mean the eigenvalue of BP in, or the eigenvalue of BP. So I'm labeling the states by the eigenvectors of BPs. So BP has two eigenvectors corresponding to the eigenvalues plus and minus 1. That's it, yeah. So exactly what you're asking. So it's true that sometimes I forget to put hats, but come on. So when I put it in the state, it's the eigenvalue. When I put in the Hamiltonian, it's the operator. OK, so we know everything about G infinity. Now let's look at G0. So you notice that at G0, my basis states are also eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So it's a very convenient basis, because my Hamiltonian for g equals 0, so for g equals 0, this basis are the eigenvectors right? Because it's, you can immediately verify that for every, so these are the eigenvalues of BPs. So H on this gives me this again. So you see that the ground state is obtained by fixing all the BPs to plus 1. Because for every time it's plus 1, I get an energy minus J. So the ground state energy is 0, is minus L squared J. And is obtained when all the BPs are plus 1 or minus 1. All the BPs are plus 1. However, if I change the eigenvalues of these things, I get exactly the same energy. So you can see that this state, BP equal plus 1, and z1 equal either plus or minus 1, or either z2 plus minus 1. So this thing is a basis in the ground space. It's four orthogonal vectors. So the ground space at g equals 0 is fourfold degenerate. So we have degeneracy. And let's see if we have a gap. How do we create excitations? We create excitations by changing the eigenvalue of some piece. So I put a vortex somewhere, and my energy goes from minus J to plus J. So I gain an energy 2J. However, remember that because the product of all the BPs is plus 1, we can only have an even number of vortices. Right? Because the product of all these minus 1s must be plus 1. So the minimum thing that I can do is to flip two of them. Okay? I cannot have odd number of vortices. if I could have an odd number of vortices, the dimension of my Hilbert space, it wouldn't be 2 to the L squared minus 1. It would be 2 to the L squared. So my E1 is 0 plus 4j. And this state is very degenerate because I can put my pair of vortices everywhere in the lattice. So the degeneracy is, this one is L squared just. Right? It's L squared times L squared minus 1 over 2. Okay. And as I go to more excited states, so now I've created two pairs of excitations. And the degeneracy is, you know, now it's L squared choose 4. So now we see why we like this interpretation of vortices, counting them not in the large loops but in the plaquettes. I am counting how many excitations over the ground state I have. Okay? So that's why we want to count them in this way, because these are the operators in the Hamiltonian, not the large loops. Yeah?
Sorry, can you explain again why we have to have an even number of vortices?
Yes, because the product of all these eigenvalues is plus 1. You cannot have an odd number of minuses. So we know the whole spectrum at G equals 0, okay, of the lattice Z2 gauge theory. So in particular, now let's focus on the ground space. We have said that it's fourfold degenerate, and that there is a gap. So here we have over our spectrum. And the reason why I do continuous lines is because it's highly degenerate for every energy level. And then I have 4 states, and this gap is 4j. And now I want to understand, who are these 4 states, right? So we know these 4 states correspond to 4 different eigenvalues for the pair Z1, Z2, that are the expectation values of the non-contractible loops around the 2 holes in the torus.
Sorry,
don't
understand correctly that the gap between the excited states, different excited states, should be the same as ground state at the first excited. So because, for example, U2 differs from U1 also by 4J.
Yeah. Yeah. At G equals 0, this spectrum, so you're not happy that these lines are narrower than this.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but then you don't see anything. So these lines have the same width. So the reason why I do it like this is because okay, it's easier to see. But imagine that I, instead of having a J that is the same for every plaquette, now J is a disordered field. Okay? Now this one would be somehow the narrowest line, and the others could be whatever. So somehow I'm drawing it like this because I just want to draw the attention on this gap, and the others are whatever, because it's not essential whether J is constant or not. But now, for the sake of simplicity, let's keep it constant, okay? Because otherwise there are complications. So where was I? So G equals 0, we have this 4. So we know how to distinguish these 4 states. But This is not enough to know to distinguish them, because in fact, if they really are spins one half, so it's not sufficient to find the quantum number. You should also find the operator that changes this quantum number, right? So you know that something is a spin one half if you find a pair of operators that anti-commute and that they both square to the identity. So what are, in other words, what are the operators that allow me to go from one to the states, of the states to the other? Any suggestions? So it's something similar, but we have to be slightly more careful, because so if this was my Z1, okay, so you see that if I give me another call. That if I take sigma x on all these spins, nothing happens. They actually don't touch. Sigma x operates on this spin and this spin, but not on this any of those. So you have to run this other non-contractible loop on the dual lattice. Means I am operating sigma x on all these spins. So now I will define operators WX on this gamma prime. The prime reminds me that they are curves on the dual lattice, such that this is the product of sigma X on the J's that belong to the spins in the dual lattice. And now let me call this one x1, so based on this curve. So now you see that x1 and z1 anti-commute because they only cross at one point. So here they realize actually sigma x, sigma z algebra, and obviously x1 square is the identity. So this basis Z1 equal plus minus 1, Z2 equal plus minus 1, could be also written as, in this way, could also be written like, let me just choose the one Z1 equal plus 1, Z2 equal plus 1. And then I operate with x1, x2, and I put ij here. With ij being either 0 or 1. And they call this state psi ij. So I'm not doing anything fancy here, right? So when I have a 0, 0, I'm doing nothing. I have a plus 1, plus 1. When I have 1, 0, I'm operating with this one, and I have a minus 1, plus 1, and so on and so forth. But now we know what are the operators that allow me to go from one to the other. So what are the other properties of the ground state other than this degeneracy? So the first thing that we want to check is whether this system magnetizes. So we know that in the classical model, it cannot magnetize because of the Elitzur theorem. So in the quantum version, does the Elitzur theorem hold? Not only it holds, it's actually very easy to prove because of the gauge formalism. So let me take one of these states, any state, in the ground space, okay? So let me just say zero. Some state in the ground space. So any combination of these basis states in the ground space, that doesn't matter. And I want to compute the expectation value of some operator that breaks the local gauge symmetry. So some sigma z at some link I. This is what we did. So do you remember when we did, so this is our average, right? Our expectation value. In the classical case, we have to do the sum over all the configurations, put the Boltzmann factor. Here is just the expectation value of some operator. So you remember what we did? We did the local gauge transformation in a site that was neighboring the link that we are taking in consideration. So let me do the same. Let me choose a site N such that I belongs to N. And let me operate a gauge transformation. But now here I really get an identity because the ground space, of course, is gauge invariant. This is a state in the gauge invariant Hilbert space. So I can write this, right? Then I have my sigma z. Then I can write this. Do you agree? Gn Gs is Gs because it's a gauge invariant state. So now let me pass this on this other side. Because they have an edge in common, and this breaks the symmetry. So they anti-commute. And the only thing they can do in Z2 is to anti-commute. So I get Gs minus G dagger G sigma Z G. And this is the identity, because these are unitary operators, and they have a minus. So this is equal to minus itself, so it's zero. No magnetization. You cannot spontaneously break a gauge symmetry. When you implement the gauge symmetry in the gauge structure, actually, the Hilbert space, this comes out in almost a trivial way. Now, let's look at correlation functions. So, Gs, sigma zi, sigma zj, Gs. We are still at G equals zero, okay? Well, for the same reasons, also these are identically zero. So we have realized the model whose ground space as both a degeneracy, no local order parameter, and all the correlation functions are actually zero. So it's almost what we promised. There are two things that are missing. So first of all, we proved this at the point G equals zero. So right now, we don't know if this is a property of a phase or it's a special point. Okay. So this is very important. Okay. We want to know if this property is conserved if we move inside the phase before a phase transition happens. At some point, there must be a phase transition because to go from degeneracy 4 to degeneracy 1, some gap has to close. But so in the space in which we are in the same phase, is this property robust? So it's a property of the order of this phase or not? So this is the first question. And the second question is, can we realize these properties and other properties that we'll see in a more physical model, a model where all the degrees of freedom are local? And this is what we shall see tomorrow. Okay. Questions?
Are you saying that the G equals zero phase is different to the J equals zero phase or the same?
Oh, What?
Are you saying that this phase is different to the phase of James was zero, or it's the same phase?
No, what I'm saying is that these properties were derived in the limit g equals zero. Now, if I put a small g, first of all, do I have a phase at all? Do I still have a fourfold degeneracy? Or immediately, as soon as I put a g, I close the gap and have a phase transition. Okay? So this is not a trivial question. And all the rest, whatever else. So all this, imagine that we prove that the gap doesn't close until a critical point of G. Then all these properties, are they still true? Or it's a property of a special point? Yeah.
So the point is because when in the J equals 0, then the G equals infinity, then we have a M, like an L squared of the generous, because you have like sort of similarities on each side. So you're saying that because the degeneracy is different, then we should have something.
In the ground space, the degeneracy for G infinity is a 1.
Oh.
It's unique ground state. This is the paramagnet, right? So all spins up is a gauge invariant state.
But because it's a different degeneracy, the question is not a can you make the claim that because they're different degeneracy, they must be different?
So because they're different degeneracies, there must be a critical point in between.
Okay.
You cannot change the degeneracy without closing the gap. So this is the point. I just said all spins up is a gauge invariant state. I correct myself. All spins right. I mean, plus in the sigma x basis. Thank you.